This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawera Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann in Otipoti, Dunedin, and I am joined from, I think she's back in Whakatane, by Mawera Karatai. Kia ora, Mawera.
Kia ora, Sam. Yes, back in Whakatane for a week and then returning to Dunedin on Sunday.
I don't know how you keep track of where you need to be.
I don't either. I think I just make it up. Actually, I use the Air New Zealand app. It's better than a calendar for me.
And your boys have flown?
Yep, well, Bo is about to leave the country. He's moving off to Italy in 2 weeks. And then Jack, I get to keep Jack until the 4th of August, and then he's off to Singapore for 2 years.
Awesome.
Yeah, amazing things have been going on here, Sam.
Indeed, and we'll talk next time when we've got more time about what's going on with the Regional Council, because it's anybody's guess.
Oh, now that's quite interesting. At least we get to keep our jobs until 2028.
Right, but you don't have long to work out what you're going to do.
Well, we've got nothing to do with it. That's the very interesting thing. So the government has said that the councils all have to come up with a plan, and the Regional Council has got no say in any of it, because the government's perspective is the Regional Council should cease to exist. And, oh, yes, we should actually have a whole conversation about that next time. I have a lot to say.
I'm sure you do. So we're doing it slightly differently today. We are running two of the Coming Up for Air shows.
Yes.
Tell us what Coming Up for Air is again.
So Coming Up for Air is an output in our Masters of Sustainable Business program at the University of Otago. So for one of our papers, we asked the students to interview someone that they admire who's working in that sustainability space. And that is an output towards completing the paper. And it's great because they get to make a real world connection. They get to explore the practicalities of that philosophical stuff they're learning in class out in the world, and they get to generate a whole bunch of credits and hopefully pass the paper. So congratulations to all of our students who are graduating this week.
Indeed. So we are hearing from Rosalind Love. Who did Rosalind talk to?
Rosalind Love talked with Tim Calder about the challenges and potential for change with the split incentive in student housing.
Here's a question that might sound obvious. Why are so many rental homes in New Zealand cold, damp, and expensive to heat? You might think it's simply negligent landlords, but the true culprit is something most people have possibly never heard of. Economists call it the split incentive, otherwise known as the tenant-owner dilemma. Here's how it works. If you're a landlord, you could spend $15,000 on better glazing or solar panels, but who gets the benefit? It's your tenants through their lower power bills and warmer homes. Meanwhile, you're out of pocket with no direct return. If you're a tenant and your power bill is, say, $400 a month, and you're sleeping in multiple layers of clothing to keep warm, You'd love to install a better heating system, but that makes no sense to renovate somebody else's house. That's the split incentive, and it's a pretty big issue. According to a 2025 Housing and Aotearoa report, 1 in 3 New Zealand households now rent, and rental properties are significantly more likely to be energy inefficient than owner-occupied homes. From an environmental perspective, households have now overtaken industry as our biggest users of electricity. The International Energy Agency says that doubling energy efficiency by 2030 would cut more carbon dioxide emissions than any other single action. So why aren't we doing it? Why are our systems designed to fail up to a third of New Zealanders? Kia ora, I'm Rosalind Love. I'm the Chair of Prime Campus, Director of ASN Media, and part of the Master of Sustainable Business program at the University of Otago. In this podcast, I want to explore how that split incentive plays out in student housing, where short-term leases, desperate demand, and old housing stock make everything worse. There is some good news. Not every landlord is being held back by the split incentive, and some are reimagining what student housing can be. One of them is here with me today, Tim Calder, the founder of Prime Campus. For more than 2 decades now, Tim has been pioneering a different approach to student property investment. Tim, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Roz, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Tim, you spend most of your year living with your family in Hamburg and then your summers here in New Zealand. So let me start with a simple question. Where do you feel most at home?
I actually feel pretty good in both places. I feel pretty lucky. There's pros and cons about both. The one thing I do really miss is the beaches in New Zealand being so close within 15 minutes. So that's something I really miss. Yeah.
And talking about home is such a natural way to step into our topic of conversation today, because when you and I think about home, we think about a place of warmth and comfort. But for many students, the reality is very different. Student flats have had a lot of media attention. There's been stories of cold, damp houses, high power bills, and the impact on students' health. A statistic that stands out to me from a nationwide study is that nearly 2/3 of students surveyed said they always feel cold in winter. From your perspective, Tim, how would you describe the current state of student housing in general when it comes to warmth and energy efficiency?
Yeah, it's a real spectrum. At one end, you've got some really excellent new developments with so that are purpose-built to high spec. And the other end, you've got some really old stock. Like in Dunedin, it's pre-1915, really old. So that still struggles to even meet today's minimum standards. So while there's some good landlords investing in quality, too many properties are still cold and inefficient. The key challenge is making sure that both the bottom end is lifted to at least the decent minimum standards.
Have you noticed any difference from the Healthy Homes legislation? And if so, what kind of changes have you seen?
Yes, it's made an impact, but it's really just setting a minimum barrier, like a minimum level of standard. And I think this is where there's so much scope to increase and improve on that. But I think that was the first step in like a long line of steps that needs to be taken to bring up the quality of housing. And this has been good in the sense it's given landlords a long period of time to make sure they meet those minimum standards, which are really minimum. Like some of them are just very basic, like having insulation in the ceiling, insulation in the floor, the walls, the heat pumps, making sure you're heating the common areas to a standard level, no drafts, ventilation, good ventilation. And again, keeping the houses dry and without moisture ingress and things like this. So very basic standards, which I think everyone should be able to achieve. And they are slowly getting to that point. And I think so, yes, it's a first step along many to lift the standard of housing in New Zealand.
And then, of course, part of the story is student culture. So in that study we did earlier this year, we found that living in these old cold flats in a way has become a rite of passage. And I think we know that from our time in Dunedin, Tim. How much do you think that culture still shapes student housing today?
Well, there's far more awareness now of the health impacts of a cold, damp housing. So I think the tenants are more looking for it when they go for viewings, and their parents are much more in behind them when it comes to their decisions. And so they're paying attention to this as well. And of course, there's a lot more media coverage. So everyone is involved in this process now, and it's much more transparent. And I think students are asking more questions about insulation and heating. And so it's much more open, and landlords obviously have to be careful about what they're providing and have to meet the market in that sense. So while there are some older, the older culture still lingers, there's a clear shift that tenants are looking for much more high quality homes, and they're more informed, and they're pushing back if the standards aren't met.
It's really great that that's changing. How do you see the balance then between wanting better housing and being able to afford it?
Students absolutely want warmer, healthier flats, but their ability to pay more is still capped. Like the average allowance, student allowance loan per week is around $323, which has to stretch across rent, power and food and everything. So there is a limit to how much they can afford. And with some parents can obviously afford to support their children's pay a bit more, but it's still a really tight a budget that students have. And landlords are aware of this, but there's because there's a shortage of housing, landlords can sort of take advantage of that and obviously continue to put high prices and not reinvest into their houses. So while there's a willingness to pay more for quality, the balance is always constrained by that weekly cap.
So far then, we've talked about a range of barriers, the housing quality, a very basic legislative flaw, but lingering student culture and affordability constraints. The real levers for change then would seem to sit with landlords and within the wider policy environment. From your perspective, what kind of changes or disruptions could really start to shift the cycle for good?
Well, I think it starts with raising the standards over time. If the healthy home requirements continue to step up, landlords have to keep improving, but regulations on its own are not enough. Like it already creates pushback. So what would really help is pairing that with support like subsidies or tax incentives so landlords can make upgrades a way that that's financially sustainable. Other countries already do this. For example, tax deductibility if a property reaches a certain standard. And I think that's something we should all look to do here.
I would love to see that extra motivation above the legislation, I think would really help. What other factors are at play that you think might stop landlords from acting on these types of incentives?
Well, the one thing at the moment is that there's such a shortage of student housing that landlords, there's no incentive for them to actually really spend more money to upgrade the standards because their properties are really high in demand already. And the other problem is also that to spend, mum and pop investors generally don't have a huge amount of cash flow because a lot of their loans are being repaid over a period of time and leading into their retirement. So they don't have the available cash flow to then reinvest in their properties, which makes it really challenging from a financial point of view.
And those mum and pop investors that you talk about, are they the majority of the market in student property or?
I think this is almost entirely mum and pop investors. There's very few institutional landlords in New Zealand, like whereas overseas you've got some large student housing developers. But in New Zealand, we just don't have that. It's really just made up of mum and pop investors that use real estate to save for the investment for their retirement.
That's very interesting. And also, I guess another factor is there's the stereotype of students having that strong party culture and perhaps being careless tenants. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a big one. And I think landlords are sort of apprehensive to reinvest in their properties when they just think tenants are not going to look after them and they don't really care about their health and well-being. But that's changing now. I think the culture is changing. So those factors become a bigger part in terms of landlords needing to reinvest more to look after their tenants.
Big question then. How do you think we start to overcome some of these obstacles and lift the standard of student housing?
Well, I think there's a mix of things, really. I think if you were, obviously the supply side is a massive problem. So if you're able to build more purpose-built housing with clearer energy ratings so that quality flats actually stand out, that would be really beneficial. Financially, I think small landlords need to feel more confident that they won't be left out of pocket. So things like those subsidies I mentioned earlier or tax breaks, green loans, that sort of thing, make a real difference. The stereotypes are also changing too, as I said, like about the cultural changes and how students now are not all about sort of the party culture. It's actually really important for them to get really good degrees and grades and everything like this. So I think if landlords are aware of that and realize that the tenants actually appreciate their housing and they're going to look after it, I think that would make a massive difference as well.
What kind of initiatives could help build that understanding between the landlords and tenants?
Well, it could come from local housing groups or even the universities, but really it's about showing landlords there's a sort of positive feedback loop. If they put more into their properties, tenants will respect them more, and that makes it easier to keep improving over time.
Let's talk about Prime Campus. How would you describe your philosophy for student housing, and what first led you to take a different approach from the standard rental model out there?
Well, most landlords that I worked with just sort of handed over the keys to the tenants at the start of the tenancy, and that was where they left it. And I thought there was a lot, like these tenants, it was the first time they went to the housing, so it was the first time they'd done anything, connected the power, connected the internet. So I thought there's a lot more value that you could provide them during the tenancy, and I thought that was something that
was completely not done. And it's something that we're really, I was really keen to sort of help, because it's something that I'm naturally good at, is the admin is my superpower. Yes. So I thought that was something I could just sort of help with and make the process easier and simple for them. And I think how that's, it sort of become my philosophy in the end, is if you provide this high quality supportive housing that's easier to move into and to manage during the tenancy, I think it improves the well-being of the students because they don't have to worry about this. They have no stresses and they don't have to worry about the logistics of setting up accounts and things like this. So it just makes their whole experience much more stress-free.
And how have your views on what makes good student housing evolved over your 20 plus years in the sector?
What I've realised is how important it is to make and build genuine connections with your student tenants. I think there's obviously, this is their first time going to into a flatting experience. I think the landlord is a sort of big, scary type of person that that is quite intimidating. Whereas if you actually connect with them on a personal level, like where you become sort of their partners in this tenancy, I think it makes them feel really trusting of you, and they're happy to share their experience. What they think improvements are to their flat, what you could do, which, like, we had one example where there was this long hallway in one of our flats and the tenants sort of said, hey, have you ever thought about putting a door in there just to sort of make that living space easier to heat? And it was a brilliant idea. And I think tenants wouldn't open up to you about this if they didn't sort of trust you and you hadn't built that connection with them. So that was a real big one for us. And I think the benefit of that when you're able to sort of satisfy and make these improvements to the flat, and if they have a better experience, a warmer house, a dry home, it really feeds into their whole university experience, the ability for them to engage in their course and to get better grades and that sort of thing. And it's, you notice that from the improvements that you make. So I think it's a massive thing that's really helped us.
It's definitely a very different experience to the one I lived at university.
Yeah, I look, same with me as well. A lot has changed over the years.
I would love to talk about your recent solar panel trial. Research shows that landlords and student housing are about a third less likely to invest in energy efficiency upgrades, and many are just catching up with the basics like insulation. But you've taken things a step further and invested in solar. What made you think that this is worth trying in student housing?
Well, I think it actually goes back 5 years when we started managing our tenants' power. Now, it was something at the time that I sort of tried to explain to tenants that it was a bit of a privilege, because under tenancy law, you can't just take over tenants' power bills. But we sort of, it was a thing that we built on our trust and said, hey, look, let's try and do this. We could get better rates for you if we take longer-term contracts. And we could also help future years if we could show them what it costs to run a student flat over the months. So it sort of helps them budgeting. And obviously, this idea was brought into, and we could see the improvements we're making, obviously, not just for the tenants that were in there, but obviously for future tenants that were that would help with their budgeting. But then we thought, how can we take this further? And that's when the solar idea came along, because we could see, well, look, now we know that the usage and how the tenants are using the flats, let's work out ways that we can actually subsidize the usage during peak times or try and offset some of their costs. And so this is where the solar idea came in. And it's obviously it's in its infancy at the moment, so we've still got a lot to learn from this, but it's something that, yeah, we're trialing at the moment and really hoping that we can provide more value for our student tenants.
And it's a win-win-win, because you get the better planet outcomes too.
Yeah, that's right. And it matters to our tenants too. Gen Zs really care about sustainability. So if we can give them a warm, healthy home that's also good for the environment, that's a big plus.
Amazing. I read an article recently that said in sustainability, that idea of the first mover advantage doesn't always hold true. Often the ones who go first face the hardest challenges, changing those norms, taking on the higher costs and learning through their mistakes. As someone who's taken a leadership position in sustainable student housing, what's convinced you it's worth doing, even when the returns aren't necessarily immediately obvious?
Well, for me, it comes down to the relationship that we've built with our tenants and that trust that we've built and the feedback that we're getting from them because we've built that trust and those relationships. So over time, we've been able to obviously use the feedback we've got to continue to improve our flats and to improve our flatting experience. And this goodwill has created a lot of positive sort of marketing for us, I suppose. We've had loads of referrals come in from either friends or family that have said, hey, look, you've got to try a prime campus flat. And that's been, yeah, really successful for us. In fact, one of our flats, the tenants have recommended the following year's tenants for over 6 years now, which is massive for us because it just means that we've got a constant supply of these tenants and people are actually competing for our flats. So that type of, I suppose, reward for us is huge. And that obviously builds up the trust and the ability to attract great tenants. So it's really worthwhile for us.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time together today, Tim, but I'd love to end on a bit of a thought experiment for you. If you had the power to reshape student housing, what's one change you'd make that you think would make a big difference?
If I could change one thing, I think it would be the way banks structure loans for student housing. Right now, landlords have to repay both principal and interest quickly, which ties up cash and limits improvements. If student housing was treated as a distinct asset class with the option of long-term interest-only loans, landlords could free up cash flow and reinvest year after year. And that's the key. It only works if landlords are expected to reinvest that capital back into the properties. Done right, and you'd see a compounding effect. Flats improving instead of being run down, healthier homes, and stronger demand from students. And the payoff would be huge. Students living in quality housing are more likely to thrive academically and personally, to stay in New Zealand, and to feed their talent back into the economy. The benefits would easily outweigh the risks or costs of government support. In fact, it's one of the smartest ways we could tackle the brain drain.
I can see a lot of value in that idea, not just for landlords and tenants and banks, but just for New Zealand as a whole, actually. It's when students live in these warm, healthy homes, like you said before, Tim, they really do thrive. And it really matters because one day they'll be the ones that go on to run the country, probably.
Yeah, that's right.
Tim, thank you so much. It's always such a joy to talk big picture with you. I think you are incredibly inspiring and the student property market is so much stronger for having you in it.
Oh, thank you, Ros.
So today we've unpacked why the split incentive is so persistent in student housing and explored what it might take to change that. Tim has shown us that there is another way forward, where value isn't just measured in profit, but in healthier tenants, stronger communities, and a lasting reputation. Because at the heart of it all, this isn't about numbers, it's about people. And I think when we get that bit right, everything else will follow. Thanks for listening. So
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm with Moira Karatai, and we are listening to contributions from Coming Up for Air. Who have we got next?
Next, we've got Matt McLaughlin in his interview with Joe DeYoung from Purdue Carbon, Accountability of Science-Based Targets.
That sounds good. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Matt McLaughlin, and welcome to today's podcast, where we unpack the real stories behind climate action. Our focus today, who's truly accountable for corporate climate targets? Science-based targets are everywhere, but are they driving genuine change, or is it just business as usual? The missing link is often executive leadership. Research by Gscom et al. 2021 examined the gap between corporate climate pledges and delivery, and Jiang et al. 2025 highlighted governance barriers to ambitious target setting, shedding light on why so many boards are hesitant to commit to transparent goals and what this means for the future of sustainability. Joining me today is Joe DeJong from Purdue Carbon, a leader in carbon strategy. Together, we'll unpack what's holding decision makers back and how we can push for accountability at the top. Let's get into it. Joe, for all the listeners out there, tell us a bit about yourself. Who is Joe?
I am a director of Purdue Carbon, sustainability consultant and sustainability project manager. And I've been in the space since 2011 is when I finished my master's and finished up at university and ended up jumping straight into it. I live and breathe sustainability in terms of my role and work with international clients as well as clients based here in Aotearoa in New Zealand.
Where do you feel most at home?
Two places, and one is literal. I left New Zealand when I was in my mid or early 20s, and I didn't really appreciate the bounty of what we have in terms of amazing nature. And the awesome bush and backcountry huts that we have. So for me, it's getting out deep in the bush and being in the trees and seeing all the biodiversity and birds and wildlife that we have across the motu. And one of the key reasons I do what I do is because I want to leave a positive impact and I want to support my clients in having a positive impact as well. And I guess this is a little bit more evident since becoming a dad. So I now have a daughter and I want my daughter to grow up in a thriving planet. So we're a pretty active household and I want her to, I guess, get into nature and experience that as well. And then the flip side is I'm most at home in terms of getting amongst data. So I love data. You can't really manage what you don't measure. And so for me, I look at data, insights into data in terms of setting targets, working with my clients and aggregating data across all of their different areas of their business and work out pathways forward. So I decided to take two different, avenues in terms of that question.
Is there a moment that sort of sparked your passion for data collection in terms of, you know, drawing on the research of targets today?
I studied at the University of Waikato doing a management degree. And I was originally going to major in accounting because that's what I was doing at high school. And actually, there was a university professor there who sparked my interest in sustainability. So I ended up weaving that into a few different papers and decided to major in strategic management. And I ended up continuing on and doing a master's of management and sustainability. And that same lecturer ended up being one of my supervisors. So she was quite a strong motivator for me getting into that space. And she ended up receiving a large Marsden research grant with another professor. And so I was able to use that as part of a scholarship and research project for my master's thesis and ended up focusing on Lake Taupo and the business case for a collaborative partnership towards sustainable development. So I looked at how businesses were interacting with some policy at the local and national level in terms of the land use, because they were trying to stop the nitrogen leach into the lake. I guess that sparked my interest in that research project initially. I wasn't a scientist, but I was really interested in data. And I wanted to get into the sustainability reporting space. And I ended up reaching out to someone through a contact to basically do an internship in Germany. And they ended up getting me to come over. And I ended up finishing up my thesis and going over to Stuttgart, Germany. And that company is who I worked with for the next 10 years in their German office, then coming back into the New Zealand office, and then going over to the London office. That's the start of my love of data in terms of sustainability reporting. So All things quantitative and qualitative, from carbon reporting to diversity inclusion metrics, and supporting companies at that level, at that high level, implementing a data collection platform so they can collect that data and then use that for aggregated reporting, whether it was voluntary or mandatory reporting. So yeah, that was sort of the path in terms of my career path to that point. And then when COVID hit, we ended up coming back to New Zealand, and I ended up setting up Pure Carbon to continue supporting a lot of international clients who wanted to carry on working with me. So now I support clients, again, collecting data and supporting them with the aggregation of that, and at the enterprise level across all of their different suppliers or operations, and then help them set targets, science-based targets, near-term and long-term, and track progress to try and meet those targets. So,
given your background and all the amazing work that you've done, how has your views of sustainability changed over time?
Yeah, it's quite interesting, I guess, because I started off doing this internship in Germany back in 2011, and a lot of the clients that we were working with back then were doing this from a voluntary perspective. So they were trying to collect data across their operations for mainly their operational emissions, so their scope 1 and scope 2 emissions. And I think that's probably been the biggest shift that I've seen since then, is a move away from voluntary to mandatory. If the entity is listed on a stock exchange, that's now a requirement. And businesses who are strategically moving in this space and seeing it not as a tick box exercise or a compliance exercise, but as a strategic opportunity to say, well, understanding these are all my climate risks, what are the opportunities and where can we head? Where do we want to be as a business over the next 10, 20, 50, 100 years? So that's probably the key thing, voluntary to more mandatory. I think back then as well, it was more probably narrative as companies were trying to produce sustainability reports, whereas now it's very much data driven, and you need to have credible data, and there are stakeholders now who will delve into that and call you out if that is not credible information. And I think as well, back then, a lot of companies were doing this at the operational level, whereas now companies are realizing that value chain is one of the biggest areas of, particularly from the climate side of things. Sometimes that can be 80 or 90% of the emissions for a company. So you need to work with your supply chain partners across that value chain to get data from those partners, to really work with those partners to try and decarbonize across your value chain. And there now seems to be, at the moment, this move to reporting. And I think over the next 5-10 years, we'll definitely see a move to more action. So being able to understand how companies are quantifying the impacts and what are they doing in terms of investing capital to really drive a change over those, to meet those near-term targets.
What's your view, and based on the fact that you've worked with so many companies around the world, in terms of the effectiveness of science-based targets in driving real emissions reductions?
To submit a science-based target, it shows that you're getting external verification and validation of that target. And you can set targets from operational emissions, a near-term and long-term target, and the value chain, so scope 3 targets. The number of companies is increasing year on year, and there's now a move to more net zero based targets. It's been super helpful to drive change, and particularly the bigger entities who are saying, actually, for our key suppliers, over the next 5-10 years, we want you to be submitting science-based targets as well, because that shows that they're wanting to have a meaningful impact across the supply chain and actually decarbonize the client who is requesting that as part of their procurement policies, to actually decarbonize their own value chain. What we're seeing at the moment in the market is boards potentially being slightly concerned about whether or not they can reach these targets, particularly the scope 3 targets across the value chain. And there are a myriad of reasons, whether that's technology isn't around yet to be able to decarbonize hard to abate sectors, data uncertainties. There are data sources that, if you use a spend-based approach, because there aren't readily available emission factors to be able to quantify those particular impacts. Yep. It just means that there's a bit of uncertainty. And actually, I think we're seeing some companies now who are realizing that they're not going to meet their 2030 targets, and they are stepping away and not recommitting with a science-based target. So my question then would be, well, how are you going to continue to show credibly that you have a target, that actually is rigorous, and that you're trying to reduce your emissions across your value chain, or whether it's scope 1 and 2 across your own operations? It'll be interesting what happens over the next few years, because there are large private investors and also capital markets such as banks. They've tailored better rates or better lower interest rates to those science-based targets. So if a company is meeting their targets year on year, they get that lower interest rate. And I think we might start to see potentially some pushback, because all of a sudden you have a higher interest rate potentially, because you aren't able to meet those targets.
I think the incentive.
Yeah, but I guess the risk is, on the flip side, from a board, I'd be questioning, well, what is the risk for not setting credible targets and setting a lower emissions target? You're not actually, are you linking to a 1.5 degree scenario or under 2 degree scenario? And that was the ultimate aim of science-based target initiative, so that you can have a credible science-based target that the company has to try and achieve.
Why do you think executive leadership is often missing from the conversation around climate target accountability?
I think it's definitely moving, particularly if you look at New Zealand. We're now in year two of the New Zealand climate disclosures. Australia is just implementing their climate disclosures, so this is their first year, and there are a lot of other geographic jurisdictions that have, I guess, legislated for this to be included. I think in terms of boards not fully committing to ambitious or transparent goals, one, there's a capability gap, I think, where boards are still upskilling. So in New Zealand, we're now seeing they're becoming a little bit more, I guess, fluent and understanding of the requirements around disclosures in general in relation to climate. I think there's been probably more short-term pressure. Ultimately, a board should be looking at very much long-term, and maybe just a reluctance or not wanting to commit to such ambitious targets, because there is that uncertainty around whether it's regulation or potentially carbon pricing or technology, like I mentioned before. But the flip side is, if a board isn't understanding their climate risks and they're not then evaluating the opportunities, there is going to be potential reputational risks and further financial risks in relation to climate impact. So look at, for example, in New Zealand, they managed to step away from their 2030 target, and that was mainly because the sustainable aviation fuel is not where it needs to be in New Zealand at this stage. They've had other technical issues in terms of engine issues. So for them, they weren't going to meet their 2030 target. And so they've announced that they were stepping away from their science-based target. But they did it in a transparent way. They have set other goals. But I think that's been one of the key things. Another client I'm seeing, they're looking already to recommit their targets. they haven't hit 100%. They're about 80-90%, but they're recommitting mainly because they want budget, and the board sees this as a strategic imperative, but they can understand the reputational risks. And so they want to set a credible target, and that actually drives the board to start investing and assigning capital to try and meet those targets as well. So it's sort of that circle, and that if the board doesn't have a full understanding and there's a capability gap, you need to upskill your board, but you also need to be doing the analysis of your climate risks and opportunities, and that needs to be fed back to the board so that they can understand and make decisions as well.
What would be your advice for a company that doesn't have science-based targets and was to set these up?
You can still use the framework and not have it audited or reviewed by the science-based target initiative. The first step is to go through and understand your inventory, so your operational scope 1 and 2 emissions, and then a materiality, screening of all of the different scope 3 categories to see what categories are material, and then to start working on gathering that data and understanding what levels of uncertainty exist in your data. If, let's say, you've procured $10 million worth of goods and services throughout the year, but you don't have an understanding of the individual life cycle assessment for each of those emissions categories, you can use the spend-based approach and apply emission factors per dollar spend. And you can do that as a first initial step and then slowly try and improve your data quality over time. So understanding of the inventory first, and then you can go ahead and start forecasting your glide paths. How likely are you going to achieve those targets? If you set a 20, 30, 40% reduction through to 2035 or 2040. So you can do some different scenarios and then think about a target that you want to set. What actions do we need to implement to try and reach that target? And how can we allocate capital to support and try and meet those targets? So that would probably be the first thing. Initial screening and then scenario analysis, and then tie that into overall strategy and how to get there, operationalize it.
Awesome. Great advice. All right, Joe. Now, as we close out all podcasts, I want to ask you one more question to end things on. If you could change one thing in the world, what would you change?
So I jotted down a few things, and I might try and be cheeky and merge some of them together. But I think at the moment we're seeing some jurisdictions stepping away from climate disclosures and some adopting a particular standard. So I would sort of think about, or I would implement a universal disclosure regime globally. So it's the same for every entity, and at least there's comparability then in terms of all the different disclosures and potentially target setting as well. I would have a carbon price that would be universal across all jurisdictions as well, no loopholes or exemptions, and I would link that as well to nature-based biodiversity credits, and a lot of the profits or revenues would go into funding climate adaptation. I guess the other element I would implement would be a phase out of all fossil fuels and have a treaty internationally so that countries don't start exploring and looking for fossil fuels and getting rid of subsidies. So I know that's more than one, but that's what I do.
I think you merged those things together very nicely and would create quite a betterment for the world. So I hope those things do change based on your thoughts. And I, again, just want to thank you for joining us today, Joe, and wish you all the best with your future endeavors.
No, thank you for having me.
What I really enjoyed about both of those is that listening to the students using that language that they've learned in classroom and actually seeing how it's applied in the real world, in that real world context. And the way that the people that they've worked with in their interviews have engaged back. It really just must be really heartening for the students, but also I find it really exciting for our future. We're in good hands, Sam, with people like these guys.
Indeed, I've been thinking that for the last few months of these shows. We're off to Spit Ends this week, so let's go out to Icy Red. Been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic and the University of Otago. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. Today we had two contributions, that from Rosalind Love with her conversation with Tim Calder, and Matt McLaughlin's conversation with Joe Dionne. With Moira Karatai, I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.